infinite complacency, people went to and fro over the earth about their little affairs, serene in the assurance of their dominion over this small, spinning fragment of solar driftwood, which by chance or design, man has inherited out of the dark mystery of time and space.
Well, if you ask me what it feels like to be a freak.
Greetings, you are listening to Savage Science Radio here at Jackalope 105 FM, and I am your host, Tracy Savage. Well, if you didn't catch last week's show, this is part two, so you're going to have to go to the archives and download that. So that you can get the first half, which was great. And there was an actual historic moment. Neil deGrasse Tyson lost his train of thought. It was really, really entertaining. And what was it? The Great Debate, the Storytelling of Science. It comes from the Origins Project at ASU, and it was the final night in the Origin Stories weekend, which was the beginning of April 2013, so it just happened. They focused on the science of storytelling and the storytelling of science. They featured a panel of esteemed scientists, public intellectuals, and award-winning writers, including well-known science educator Bill Nye, astrophysicist Neil deGrasse Tyson, that we just mentioned, evolutionary biologist Richard Dawkins, theoretical physicist Brian Greene, Science Friday's Iru Flattow, popular science fiction writer Neal Stephenson, executive director of the World Science Festival Tracy Day, and Origins project director Lawrence Krauss. They discussed the stories behind cutting-edge science, from the origin of the universe to exciting technologies that will change our future. That's, you know, nice, short presentation. They demonstrated how to convey the excitement of science and the importance of helping to promote a public understanding of science. The panel discussion was provocative and entertaining, and this is the finale to the Origin Stories weekend. I hope you enjoy.
Moving from something to something else, I don't want to say it. Let me call on Richard. Thank you.
Without ever violating the laws of physics in any way whatsoever, Darwinian natural selection has put together on this planet, and I would conjecture on rather a lot of other planets as well, something utterly extraordinary. The world of complexity, which is unknown to physicists, the world of complexity, which is the world of biology, and on this planet at least, has produced the human brain, which is capable of understanding the process that gave rise to it, capable of making a model of the universe in which we stand. I have coined the phrase the genetic book of the dead to describe the gene pool of a species, in the sense that the chisels of the sculptor, which is natural selection, work away at carving the shape of the gene pool of the ancestors of every animal, plant, alive, carving it into the shape required for the animals concerned to survive in their particular environment. And that what that means is that the gene pool of, say, a camel is a kind of description of ancestral deserts. The gene pool of an antelope is a description of the savanna of the ancestors. It's a description of the lions or leopards that the ancestors escaped from. And reciprocally, the gene pool of a lion is a coded description of the prey that the ancestral lions caught. So the gene pool of every species is a unique informational description of the ancestral worlds in which they survived. And mostly all the genes in the gene pool share the same ancestral history. They all share the same, we could almost call it, experience of the past, ancestral experience. But wouldn't it be interesting to find a place where some of the genes in the gene pool have had a different ancestral experience from others? This would be a critical, almost an experimental test. And I want to tell you a story about one such example, cuckoos. The European cuckoo parasitizes quite a large number of different species. You know they're brood parasites. You know that the female does not lay an egg in her own nest. She goes and finds a nest of a host species. It might be a hedge sparrow, it might be a meadow pipit, it might be a reed warbler, it might be a robin, and deposits an egg in the nest, having removed one egg from the host nest. The young cuckoo hatches out first, before its foster siblings, and then the first thing it does is to toss out the eggs of the other of the foster species. The young cuckoo, the first thing it does, it gets the egg into a sort of hollow in its back, and it shuffles its way backwards over the edge of the nest, tosses the egg out. Obviously, it has no idea why it does it. It's got no idea of anything very much. This is built into the nervous system. And the cuckoo has many, many other fascinating adaptations to its brood parasitic way of life. Now, here's the point. The same species, Cuculus canorus, the same species parasitizes a large number of different host species. And when it lays an egg in each of the nests, each host species, the eggs mimic those of the host species. So when a female cuckoo lays an egg in a reed warbler nest, the egg that it lays looks like reed warbler eggs. When it lays it in meadow pipit nests, the egg is dark, almost black. It looks like a meadow pipit egg, and so on. How can this happen? How can the female cuckoo possibly produce the right kind of egg, given that it's got the same genes as all the other cuckoos in the species, all one species? It's a bit of a mystery. And the answer is almost certainly known, and it comes back to my point about different parts of the gene pool having different experience. Each female cuckoo learns the nature of the nest in which she herself was brought up. So there are females who are brought up in robin nests, and they return when they're adults to robin nests and lay eggs in robin nests. A female that was brought up in a reed warbler nest, when she grows up, she will return to reed warbler nests. Well, that's all very well, but they're still the same species. Now, here's the thing. As you know, in mammals, sex determination is done by an XXXY system, such that males have different sex chromosomes. One is called Y, one is called X. Females have the same, X and X. And if you work it out, when you cross an XX and an XY, 50% of the offspring will be XY male, 50% will be XX female. So a Y chromosome in a mammal like us has only had experience of male bodies back through history. X chromosomes have had two-thirds of their time in female bodies and one-third in... Have I got that right? I can't be bothered to work it out. But the point is that in birds, it's the other way round. In birds, it's the female sex, which is XY, and the male sex, which is XX. So there is one part of the genome of a female cuckoo which has only ever had experience of female bodies, and a robin cuckoo female, her Y chromosome can look back on a long history of nothing but robin nests. Well, not quite nothing but at least for a long way, nothing but robin nests. A reed warbler female has got a Y chromosome that can look back on a long history of reed warbler nests. All the other genes in the genome can look back on a mixed history of all the different species that are parasitized. But the Y chromosome has unique experience. And so the whole thing is explained on the hypothesis that egg coloration is carried on the Y chromosome. And that enables females to be specialists in one particular kind of host. They learn which kind of host they were brought up in themselves, and so this learning process sees to it that the Y chromosome has this unique experience. Now, every now and again, a female cuckoo will, of course, make a mistake. They're not perfect. Nothing's perfect. So a reed warbler cuckoo, for example, may by mistake lay an egg in a robin nest. And, of course, her egg will then be very conspicuous. It won't look right. And the chances are that it'll be killed. It'll be thrown out by the foster parent. But that's how these new gentes, as they're called, female races, these new gentes come into being by females making a mistake. Now, if you look at the perfection of the egg mimicry in the different gentes, the different races of females, only females have races. The males are all the same race, if you see what I mean. Robin cuckoos are exceedingly poor mimics of robin eggs. Meadow pipit cuckoos are exceedingly good mimics of meadow pipit eggs. And the hypothesis of Nick Davies, who's the main person who worked on this, is that cuckoos and their hosts are engaged in what's been called an evolutionary arms race. Arms races occur between predators and prey, parasites and hosts. And the idea is that robin cuckoos have only recently entered upon their arms race with robins. And therefore, neither the cuckoos have had time to develop perfection of egg mimicry, nor have the robins had time to develop perfection of discriminating the eggs. And that's why the egg mimicry is poor, and yet it still works. Whereas meadow pipits have been engaged in a much longer arms race against meadow pipit cuckoos, and that's why both of them have reached perfection, have reached a much higher level of perfection on the cuckoo side, the egg mimicry, and on the meadow pipit side, the discrimination. Isn't nature wonderful?
Fantastic story.
Bill? Cuckoos?
Cuckoos. Sort of. Ah, great. Science! Thank you all. It's so good to see you. I believe all of my colleagues, I am an engineer. Let me emphasize, like my colleagues, I'm a human, but engineer. And maybe some of you saw that right away. People recognize you at parties. Hey, you're an engineer. Your pants don't reach the floor, that's how you can tell. Hey, listen, man, can you fix the blender? You're the engineer. Yeah, I can fix the blender. Here's what you do. Hold the plug in the wall firmly. And then just hold the blender motor under some cold running water. Now, see, that's funny if you're scientifically literate. So my older brother, tremendous influence on me, had a wonderful physics teacher, Woodrow Wilson High School, Washington, D.C. And he told my brother the story, who told me the story. Michael Faraday, in 1828, then through 1831, would do the Christmas lectures at in London, which is back east someplace. And he did this demonstration, where he had a coil of wire on one end of a laboratory bench, connected to another coil of wire by two wires, the terminal wires of the coils. So he goes down here with a bar magnet, reasonably powerful magnet, which you could find in those days, and moves it, if I may, in and out of the coil, with respect to the coil. And then, yeah. Here's the thing, you know, I was in college, okay? And I don't want to trouble you, I know there are a lot of grown-ups here and stuff, but that never goes away. That it's always, it's still funny. The X, it's still there. So he moves the magnet at this end of the table, and the compass needle moves at this end, as if by magic. Of course, it wasn't magic, it was
science!
Yes. So the story was embellished. And it was presented to me that he did this demonstration with such success so often that he presented it to the Queen of England. And the Queen of England is supposed to have said to him, "Mr. Faraday, of what use is it?" And here's where I just admire the guy, and I admire what we in the United States perceive as the British way of thinking. He did not say, "Lady! Would you look? That's at that end. I'm at this. I'm not touching it. What? Are you high? I mean, come on."
I love it. You guys are awesome.
But that's not what he said. According to the story, he said, "Madam, of what use is a newborn babe?" Now, I don't know how much time you have spent with newborn babes, but they're not that useful. They're loud, and they leak, and there's a lot of times they don't seem to understand a word you say to them. But with that said, everybody, first of all, I mean, looking with all due respect, it was King George IV, at first, and then it was William IV, so there was no queen involved. When I did the Science Guy show, we had a researcher who was very diligent about this, and he never presented it to the monarch. He presented some woman, a normal person, came up to him and asked him this question. But look around, everybody. Everything in this room, everything, the lights, the curtains, the paint, the clothes you're wearing, the upholstery, the floor, the stage, everything here owes its existence to that discovery. To the discovery that not only is there a connection between electricity and magnetism, but there's a connection between electricity and the moving of the magnetism, the flux. And that discovery, dare I say it, changed the world. But this is this process of science that this guy spent, I guess he took tremendous pride in his demonstrations, and he really perfected this to show it to people. This discovery had a deep effect on me. Now, when I was a kid, I delivered the newspaper. I was a paper boy. That was the title. In the Washington Post on Sundays, there'd be Ripley's Believe It or Not. It's still there. It's a different paper, but still there. And would say from time to time, they would run the story roughly, "According to aerodynamic theory, bumblebees cannot fly." And this made quite an impression on me. And I spent some time watching bumblebees. And it became clear to me that the bees are fine. The problem is with the theory. So I wonder, continually, I wonder how many things are right under our nose that we just don't know anything about. I had a Sky Streak airplane, which are still manufactured, and the older boys showed me how to lubricate the rubber motor with dishwashing soap, and I wound that thing up, man. I wound up that rubber band, and I got that thing wound up 350 turns, man. And I read on the back of the package that you can steer the aircraft by bending the vertical tail, the rudder, making a rudder, sort of. Bend. Now, okay, this is an eyewitness account, and it's from one guy. Eyewitness accounts are imperfect, and this is the way I remember it, okay? Now, most of the time when you operate these aircraft, if you've ever tried it, it's two hands. You throw it like that, or you throw it like that. But one time I threw it, and it made three perfect circles, and it came right back to my hand, like a boomerang with Bugs Bunny or something. And then I realized that I could influence objects. I realized that if you could understand things enough, you could make things and shape things and imagine traveling around the world. And you could do it with a balsa wood airplane. Just think what you could do if you worked for a big company like Boeing. And that's what I ended up doing. I worked on 747s. Relax, everybody. I was very well supervised. But these things that happen to you when you're a little kid influence you so much. And I'll bet you everybody in here is a science enthusiast, got excited about it before you were 10 years old. And this passion, this drive to know our place in the universe is what makes us special. It's what makes our species worthy. And with this PB&J, this passion, beauty, and joy, we can, dare I say it, change the world! Thank you. The engineers, you people! Thank you. Yeah, that's very good. You know, now that I've tried this, I don't think I can live without it.
Neil, you want to talk about our world or another one? So,
this one.
Okay.
So, actually, a parallel universe to this one called Ames, Iowa, which is the town where I grew up. It's the home of Iowa State University, which is a school that, in a lot of ways, is similar to this one. The main difference being that unlike ASU, ISU is not embedded in a great big city. So it's a kind of a self-contained academic community out on the out on the high prairie. And Ames, different universities develop different sort of areas of specialization depending on who's working there and what they're good at. And one thing that Iowa State got pretty good at in the middle of the 20th century was metallurgy. And so when metallurgy became a really important topic during the Manhattan Project, some of the people in Ames were called upon to make use of their skills in refining uranium. So I'm not talking about enriching uranium, which is a more difficult process and requires bigger equipment. I'm talking about the simple process of taking the ore that is mined out of the ground and producing a fairly pure sample of uranium from that. They needed it because a few hundred miles off to the east in Chicago, in a racquetball court, the world's first atomic pile was being constructed. The way this thing was built is basically a big cubical stack consisting largely of blocks of really pure graphite. And among the graphite was uranium in a sort of roughly spherical configuration. And based on the calculations that they had done with the samples of uranium that they had a pretty good idea of how big that sphere was going to have to be in order for them to get the critical reaction that they were looking for. So they built this thing up one layer at a time using the uranium that they could get. And at some point, a new kind of uranium started coming in from my hometown, which is called Spedding's Eggs. So Spedding, Frank Spedding, was a metallurgist who worked there. And he and some of the people he worked with had come up with a new way of refining uranium, which is based on the thermite reaction. So I don't know if you know about thermite. It's a very popular chemistry experiment among young and old pyromaniacs, but you basically you take basically rust. I thought that would bring some people out of the woodwork. You take basically rust and aluminum and mix them together, and once you get it lit, which is difficult to do, but once it gets going, it's incredibly exothermic, and it's spectacular, and you end up with molten metal all over the place. So anyway, it's a good way of getting oxygen stripped off of one metal and moving it over to another one, and that was what they needed to do in the case of refining this uranium. Of course, just making a big pile of powder out in the middle of the prairie and setting fire to it wasn't exactly the right way to go about it. And so they built these sort of crucibles, these really thick-walled crucibles in which they would mix the ingredients, and then they would weld it shut and set fire to the thing, and the reaction would take place inside. And much, much later, it would cool off to the point where they could go and open up the canister, and inside would be this beautiful little oval, sort of this hardened puddle of uranium, hence the term Spedding's eggs. Not quite like cuckoo eggs, but much more powerful in a certain way. So these were then put on trucks and transported to Chicago and incorporated into the atomic pile. And these eggs were so much purer than the uranium that they had been working with up to that point that they actually had to change the design of the pile at that point. So if you look at a cross-section of that pile as it was finally built, the bottom part of it is a perfect geometric sphere, but the top part is a kind of flattened oblate sphere because they realized that they didn't have to have as much uranium because they were getting better stuff from my hometown. So that was the kind of place that I grew up. There were kids in my Boy Scout troop whose dads had been present in that racquetball court when the reactor went critical. This is kind of a digression, but one of my favorite aspects of that experiment was that they were worried that it might go out of control, and so they had buckets full of a solution that was known to be a poison for this reaction, a very potent, a damper of this reaction. And so standing on top of the pile, they had graduate students holding buckets of this stuff, and their job was to dump this stuff into the pile if the needle went beyond a certain level, which it would do very, very quickly if it happened. But on no account were they to spill even a drop of it into the pile beforehand because it would completely destroy the utility of the pile and they would have to rebuild it. So anyway, for the rest of the Manhattan Project and after the war, Ames was still a place where a lot of that kind of research went on. And I can remember going into, I think it was Spedding Hall at the university and seeing under glass a wine bottle covered with the signatures of the people who were present when the experiment had succeeded. I don't know if it was there permanently or on loan, but it was one of these cheap Italian wine bottles that's in a little basket, and the scientists had all signed their names on the wicker surrounding the bottle. And later on, when I was in college, I worked as a research assistant in a lab there, and I can remember talking to a crusty old technician who liked to give the young guys a hard time. And he took a bar of metal about the size of a pencil out of an envelope on his desk, and he handed it to me. He said, "What do you think that is?" And I began weighing it in my hand and guessed all of the dense metals I knew of, like osmium, because I was a smart little physics major and I knew what all the heavy metals were. And when I had run down the list of all of them, he told me that I was holding a bar of uranium in my hand. So I kind of froze up for a second, and he snatched it out and stuffed it into an envelope and said, "You probably shouldn't hold that for very long." So the with that as background, I'll quickly tell a story from my Boy Scout troop. Just sort of going back to Bill's comments about getting a passion for science when you're young. Boy Scouts do all kinds of projects to learn about different things. And one of the projects that we were supposed to be doing was growing plants. And growing plants is a thing that happens quite a bit in Iowa, and so it didn't seem like a terribly interesting project on its own. And so some of the dads in our troop decided they were going to enliven the thing by adding a little sciencey twist. And so one of them got some corn seeds that were as close to sort of genetically identical as he could make them. They probably had all come off the same cob or something. And he took them across campus and gave them to one of the metallurgists, who went down into the hot room buried deep below the building and picked them up with a remote manipulator arm and put them over a thick lead glass wall and set them down next to a highly radioactive isotope for some period of time, and then plucked them back out, brought them to the safe side of the wall, and took them to our next Boy Scout meeting and handed them out to us. And our instructions were to take them home, plant them, water them, and bring our plants back in a few weeks' time. And one of us, there would be one prize given out for the tallest plant and another prize given out for the weirdest mutation. And so we all participated in that project. And my plants died because I'm that kind of guy. I am the notorious black thumb. But we got both kinds of plants, both sort of fully normal-looking corn plants and other plants that were not identifiable as corn by any by anyone who's ever seen corn. And we had all seen it. So that's what it was like growing up in my town, and it's an interesting and touching thing about that place that I didn't realize how weird that was until I had left that town and gone off to places where, when I would tell stories like that, people would look at me in a very funny way. So thank you.
You know, when I was a kid, I worked at a folk festival, and I love music, although I'm not very musical. And I remember specifically a few events where the best musicians in the festival would be asked to improvise. And it was amazing, because you'd see the first one, and it would just blow you away. And then you think, oh, the poor second guy. And they'd blow you away. And you could what you watched was this incredible buzz of talent and excitement, because each person was excited by the person before them. And you know, when I put this together, we had no plans. I just thought, we'll wait and see what happens. And I hope that you felt the same buzz that I felt on this stage. It was just amazing. Now, what we're going to do, I've decided that there's no need for us to discuss anymore between ourselves, from what I've heard. So we will take a break, and we're going to go directly to the questions from the audience, because I think I'd like you to have a chance to interact with these people, and I'm in awe of them, and let's thank them once again. Excellent. Okay, we've selected, they've been great questions, and we won't have time to get through all of them, but we'll see what we can do. And I'm going to, some of them are directed at individual people, some, most of them aren't. And so I'll just throw it open and people can answer for each one. This one, the first one we'll start with, I think it's an interesting one. It says, from Anne, if you could give us all a one-word piece of advice for our own science storytelling, what would it be? And P.S., thanks for showing us how sexy science is. I don't think that referred to your shirt, but it's okay. So, one, you know, that we can probably do. One word, I guess we can go across, or if you want. You don't have to be everyone. Anyone want to give a one-word piece of advice? Yes, go ahead.
Algebra. Learn algebra.
Ooh.
I got one word.
Yep.
I got one word. That one word is ambition. That is something not encoded by any practicing exam in the school system. Yet, in fact, if you look at the most successful people there ever were, they are not the ones necessarily who got straight A's. Those are the ones who had ambition, which overrides it all.
Yeah, okay. I agree. It's a long word, but it's a good one. I would say passion. I think, you know, in the terms of storytelling, too many people, and we said this last night too many people, I think, are afraid to inject their own story or their own passion when they're talking about it at science. But if you don't talk about what you're interested in, no one else is going to be interested in it.
Empathize.
What?
Empathize, because the best people, the best teachers of science and the best writers about science are the ones who can empathize with people who don't quite get it yet.
I was going to say the same thing.
Anyone else want to throw in? You've been jumping ahead? No?
Richard. Yeah.
What?
I was going to say empathize, exactly for the same reason, but I'll say instead poetry then.
Poetry. Excellent. Excellent. Anyone?
I would just say that you should be able to tell it so that your mother can understand it.
Hey, that's good. My mother never listens, but it's okay.
And if your mother's a theoretical physicist?
yeah, that's right.
She should tell you then.
No, all right, fine.
Okay, here's one that's actually a little bit related to what Neil was just talking about, but I think we can expand on it. Anita says, I've always wanted to be an astronautical engineer, but I am horrible at math, but I've got lots of passion. Can this dream ever be a reality, and where do I start? So it's an interesting question. I guess I'll start with that. I mean, I think, as Bill said, you know, math is the language of science, and I think you have to be able to be adept at it.
Math is the language of the universe.
Yes, you're right. I agree with you.
Brian?
I agree, but let me just finish, and then we can... too many people think that... you have to be a mathematical wizard to be even a physicist. I mean, much less an engineer. It takes all types. I know people who won the Nobel Prize. I know people. You don't have to be the best mathematician in your class. You don't have to be a whiz. It takes all types to do science, and that any stereotype just doesn't work. If you're interested, do it.
What's that have to do with you knowing Nobel laureates?
Who were not the best in their class.
Oh, fine. Thank you.
Okay. Who weren't necessarily even that strong in math. Okay.
But the other thing, I'll just say, you say you're bad at math. I bet you're not that bad. And I just want to remind you that there's, when it comes to math, there's no substitute for practice. It sucked for me. It sucks for, I mean, you just have to practice. So when you come to me, and say, oh, I'm bad at math, I am open-minded, of course, but skeptical. I'll bet you can do it, whoever you are.
You know, that's an important point. We were talking about it last night, too, that, and it touches on what you said. You know, I like science museums often because they show science is fun. But science is hard work, like anything, to do, like music, like anything else, to do it well. And it takes a lot of work. So you just, and if you don't enjoy it, you can't do the work. But just enjoyment alone isn't enough. You've really got to be willing to work at it.
I think what's really going on here is people presume... that in order to be good at, they presume that if the math is not coming easy, that therefore you'll never learn it. And I meant it literally, that math is the language of the universe, and it's like any other language, especially a language that does not share the Roman alphabet. So, for example, if you wanted to study Chinese, it looks completely intractable at first.
It looks like Greek.
Exactly. And so, and you can ask the question, how long does it take one to become fluent in Chinese if you're not Chinese yourself? And so it can take years, and 5 years, almost 10 years if you never go to China. You go to China, maybe 5 years of intensive exposure, and you've never done that with math. Imagine that level of exposure to math, what kind of fluency you would have at the other end of that pipeline. So at least give yourself the opportunity that any person learning a foreign language would give themselves before you turn around and say you're not good at math.
Brian,
get me started.
Yeah, you don't want to get him started. I know that from experience. You're actually you're a professor of math as well as physics, probably the only one on the table.
Yeah, and the question that comes to mind for me is, how do you know that math is the language of the universe?
I was going to say, what about the multi?
The universe told me.
Good first approximation, I'll tell you.
Now, okay, we're not doing science by revelation.
Lawrence, just wondering, because I have a question about this.
Yeah.
Could you imagine that one day far in the future we encounter some alien civilization and they say, hey, show us what you've done to understand the universe, and we bring out our math books with all our theorems and physics, and they turn to them and say, math, we tried that. Yeah, it takes you just so far. And the real way to do it is like this.
I would say that whatever that real way is, it's not manifest to us at this moment. And until that day happens, where an alien tells us how backwards we are, all I can say is that the math that we did invent out of our human brain, as you surely know, Eugene Wigner said, the unreasonable
effectiveness
of mathematics in describing the universe, the fact that it works at all is sufficient enough for me.
But I want to have a
you
no.
Got
it just because wait, it. Just because you still can't figure out your string
bigger.
Theory.
Okay. Back in
don't come to crying to me.
Back in
don't come crying to me. You can't figure it out.
No, in fact,
you got him started. See, you got him started.
Said, don't get me started.
Don't get him started.
No, but I want to go on record.
He warned you not to get him started.
Yeah, I know, I told you. But I want to go on record. I want to go on record, and this is a momentous occasion. I want to go on record as agreeing with Brian.
Is anybody keeping the record?
But no, in the sense that it is fascinating if you're a theoretical physicist to wonder when you find something fascinating, whether some mathematical formula is fascinating, whether it's a property of our brains or whether it's a property of the universe. And we just don't know, I think, is the answer. If string theory
looks
great.
Right, but let me ask you a question. Yeah. I find it slightly confusing because, Neil, you describe math as something that we create. So why is it the thing that we create is somehow intrinsic to the universe?
Isn't that awesome?
That's our description.
It's a description.
I don't lose sleep over that. I celebrate it.
It's a good thing. I celebrate it too.
Yeah, but it is a question. There may be limitations in understanding the universe because of the way our brains work, and I think
that's surely the case. That's surely the case.
And for Republicans, it's already happened. But it's but seriously, that's an interesting question, and we really have to wonder about that. And if you're again working as some of us are at the forefront of physics, you wonder at some point when it's going to end.
It's some Republicans.
Yeah. Well,
but to the questioner's question, I wouldn't worry about the possibility that mathematics is going to turn out to be ineffective in describing the universe and use that as a reason to not keep practicing. And press on.
That's right. Okay, next question.
Could be an engineering perspective.
Yeah, no, there you go. Excellent. Next question from Joel. What do you believe or hope
will be the most significant scientific advancement over the next few decades? And I know I have a pat answer to this, but I'll wait to see if anyone else has one. No?
We don't know what the next most significant scientific discovery is going to be, for crying out loud.
Exactly. The point I always say, if I knew what
it would be... Why are you guys exploring Mars? What are you going to find there? We don't know. That's why we're going.
Yes.
Crying out loud.
Great. And as an...
Wait. That's not
fair. Go on.
No, there are two kinds of exploration. One of them is, I have no idea what I'm looking for, but maybe I'll find it when I see it.
Okay,
another kind of explanation.
You can't argue with him. I've learned it. It's
another kind of exploration is we think we know what's going on, and we want to test our hypotheses. That's another kind of exploration. And one of them is there life somewhere else? We know there's life in at least one place in the universe, and that's called Earth. So what I want to do is go to the frozen surface of Jupiter's moon Europa, cut a hole, go ice fishing down there, put a submersible, see if something swims up to the camera and licks the lens. That's what I want to look for. Look for life. Life.
But Neil, you are looking for something. When was the last time you just went, I hope to discover something? You're always looking for something.
No, but whenever we look for something, we are often surprised. And I think the point is that if we really could anticipate the progress of science, it almost, in some sense, wouldn't be worth doing, because it means we'd already kind of know where we're going and what the answers are. And I think so when people ask me, what's the next great thing, I say, if I knew, I'd be doing it right now. And so I think there is this sense we are driven by questions, interesting questions, but often those questions lead us to answers that lead to more interesting questions that are totally different than the ones we came up with.
I say not just often, but most times.
Yeah, so I think that...
But you can say something about the question which you really would wish to know the answer to. And, I mean, for me it would be, what's consciousness? Because that's totally baffling.
But Richard, you know what I think?
I agree.
Not that you ask, but what I think on this is... consciousness has kind of baffled us for a while, okay? And evidence that we haven't a clue about what consciousness is drawn from the fact of how many books are published on the topic, right? We're not really continuing to publish books, not really, on, like, Newtonian physics. It's done, all right? So the fact that people keep publishing books on consciousness is the evidence we don't know anything about it, because if we knew all about it, you wouldn't have to keep publishing. So what I wonder, Richard, is whether there really is no such thing as consciousness at all, and that there's some other understanding of the functioning of the human brain that renders that question obsolete.
To that, I've got to say, like, oh, wow.
Perfect. Okay.
And am I, like, thinking? Or am I just, like, thinking that I'm thinking? Like, wow.
Will you
Richard,
stop?
Sorry. Richard. We went decades not understanding the precession of Mercury. It was this big mystery, and we invented solutions to it, like a mysterious planet Vulcan tugging on it such that its perihelion precessed. And that wasn't the explanation at all. It was obviously general relativity, another thing, not the original question we were asking. So you say you want to know what consciousness is. Maybe that's not even the right question.
How about this? What's the nature of consciousness?
Excellent. Okay, let's move on. actually, Tracy, I think I want to direct this one to you.
Who's you?
To Tracy. That's not Neil.
I'll be happy.
Okay. Okay, it says here, science has recently become somewhat trendy, popping up in the show The Big Bang Theory or in I Beep Loving Science on Facebook.
She's here.
I know she's here. Okay. Often the focus is not actually on the science, but making entertainment out of science. Is this ultimately good for science, do you think? So I think you have a perspective on that.
I do. I don't think when it's done well, it's diminishing the science or the scientists for that matter. I think that what is really spectacular is when you can take high-level science and apply storytelling and all kinds of things that we know help people learn about a subject. I mean, we learned in, again, broadcast news. I was with ABC News for many years, and if anyone said, well, we must do that story because it's very, very important, we knew that was just death because, you know, eat your peas journalism or eat your peas writing, you know, you must know this because it's important is just, it's never going to light a fire in people's imaginations, children or adults. So I don't think it's turning, you know, entertainment is not a bad word. As long as you continue to preserve and communicate the real stuff, the real science. And that's the philosophy we apply to this. We didn't want to do, nod to science and then go off and tap dance. I mean, it was really engaging with the material, but recognizing that sometimes this stuff is really hard. And you need to write it well, act it well, and
produce it well. And I have to say, you do a great job of producing. I really do.
I wanted to answer that question. Mm-hmm. All you have to look at is what is going on in this stage tonight. This is entertainment.
I hope so.
This is absolute entertainment. I'm sitting here just watching. I'm ducking out of the way sometimes. Yeah. But I'm sitting here watching it. It's making a point about science and how to convey and how to make science interesting to the public. You're getting into these. I agree. This is how to do it.
I think fun and entertainment are overrated.
That's because you're British. That's because you're British. It's okay.
People are more alike than they are different.
Science is hard, but it's worth it. It's fascinating. It's enthralling. But if we only talk about the bits that are fun and make bangs and smells and things, then we don't do science justice. We use the phrase dumbing down, and we mustn't do that. I once gave a speech at a British conference about the public communication of science, and I was ranting against dumbing down, and at the end some man got up and said, this is not an exaggeration, this is a true story. He said, maybe we need dumbing down in order to bring women and minorities into science.
Oh, no. We're gonna get there, because there are a few questions about that. In fact.
That's why we fought a war to get out of England and start a new country.
I have to say, he was booed in the original.
Okay.
Yeah, okay. Good. Absolutely. And we actually, speaking of that, we are going to have Larry Summers here at one of our events next year, so you can ask him about that if any of you know about that. But anyway, the next question is: many of you are involved or aligned with the skepticism movement. How do you keep an open mind scientifically without using skepticism as an excuse for inaction? Can a person be a proactive skeptic? I think that's an interesting question.
Are you kidding?
I knew you
thought. So I think, Lawrence, correct me, but people confuse, in the modern word that's been made up, is conflate the word cynicism with the word skepticism. It's two different words. Yeah. But I mean, I know not a lot of young people, but one is you're not going to pay any attention to anything. You just think everything's screwed up and nothing's ever going to work out right. That's cynicism. But skepticism is, you're presented with evidence and you do your best to draw conclusions based on that. So, as the saying goes, I am Bill Nye, do you believe in ghosts? No. However, I'd love to see one. And bring it on. So, I am open-minded to the idea, but the more I look into it in a skeptical frame of way of thinking, the less likely it seems. But bring it on. When I was young, the universe was slowing down. Well, it turns out that's not, right? Mm-hmm. Do I run in circles screaming? Or do I go, that's cool? But I do want to know why.
Yeah. And well, you know, and I think that's the point. It's being wrong is really the most exciting thing in science. Man. And in fact, as I often say, you know, when I debate people, speaking of skepticism, there are people who don't accept the fact that evolution is a fact. And I've spent an undue amount of time in this country talking to those people. Well, talking to school boards and others and government trying to get...
I want to applaud.
But anyway, but
the longest period.
But there's this illusion that we somehow have this pact, that we shake hands when we get our PhD. Evolution, can't question it. And, you know, we want to be right. And the people don't understand that the way to become successful is to prove your colleagues wrong. That's the way to become a well-known scientist, is to make a discovery that proves wrong. So if there was something better than evolution, if it didn't work, you know, Richard would be the first person to want to try and discover it, in a sense, because it would mean we'd learn something, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. I think we can add something to that, which is that there's an attitude in the culture that says that everybody's entitled to their opinion, and you've got to respect their opinion. No, you damn well haven't got to respect their opinion.
You know, that's a great segue because there's an opinion of Neil's that I don't like. And
really? Boy, knock me over with a feather.
Hey, actually, he's going to say it's not an opinion, but let me ask this, jump to this question.
Bring it on.
Yeah, I figure. Okay.
And we have to stop there because it is the end of the show, unfortunately. And we will bring part three, the end, the tail end of this great debate, the storytelling of science, next week. If you missed the beginning of the show, we talked about last week was part one. This is part two. And next week will be part three. If you want updates from the Origins Project, you can follow them on Facebook at /ASU Origins Project or Twitter at ASU Origins. And you can contact origins.project@asu.edu with questions. And until next week, keep your powder and your pants dry, and happy trails to you.
The greatest job on Earth, and we're not even on Earth. We're orbiting the world, you see, collecting space debris, expended rockets, expired satellites, circling the globe, endangering space flight. We're the guys cleaning up the mess, putting astronauts' families. Policy. Even a paint chip would take off my arm, traveling at orbital velocity. Collecting space junk, space waste, space dust. We make it safe for shuttles to fly. We're trash men, weightless trash men, cleaning up the crap you left behind. We got hit by Soviet trash last year. From Apollo 13. You wouldn't believe the premium on my life insurance policy. Even a toenail would cut off my head. traveling at orbit or velocity.